This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss new threats to net neutrality.
What was invented with public money and what was supposed to be a public resource is being gobbled up by you-know-who.
We'll talk with Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project, one of the country's leading authorities in this field.
With the Trump-Sessions administration, it's going to be an uphill battle.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, I understand that you've put some thought into and have written an editorial on the fact that Jared Kushner is being put in charge of policy in the Middle East.
Well, I did, and I contrasted it to the thoughts of another prominent Jew who died years ago, Albert Einstein. I grew up in a second-generation Jewish family in the 50s in a small Republican village on Lake Michigan just north of Milwaukee. Jews in America had not yet come into their own, and there was still a lot of anti-Semitism. Albert Einstein was considered America's greatest intellectual and its most prominent Jew. So we had that going for us. My mother used to put quotes from famous Jews on the refrigerator. Jonas Salk, who invented the polio vaccine, was one of them. Albert Einstein was another. With the ascendancy of Jared Kushner as Trump's advisor on Israel and Iran and Saudi Arabia, he's now perhaps America's most prominent Jew. This callow 35-year-old Kushner, whose main experience has been in real estate, who along with his father-in-law met Netanyahu at the White House in February, is now the leading advisor to Trump on Middle Eastern policy. Is there any hope that in the course of their meeting, there was a wider reopening of minds about the nature of Israel? Not a chance. It looks like Kushner will support Israel and its new ally, Saudi Arabia, against Iran, possibly leading to another Middle East war. The United States and Israel want to get Egypt and Saudi Arabia, both Sunni Islamic countries, involved in its aggression against Shia Iran. That'll be tricky. Remember that Osama bin Laden, when asked why he organized the 9/11 attack, replied that one of his reasons was American support for Israel. Bin Laden was Saudi Arabian. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. Supporting Israel against the Palestinians is not something that sits well with the Saudi population, and the Saudi monarchy knows it. What if instead of the young, inexperienced, colonial-minded, super-religious Zionist Kushner, Albert Einstein was Trump's advisor? It's useful to know that Einstein advocated a binational state in Palestine with equal rights and equal power for Arabs and Jews. In 1946, 2 years before the establishment of the State of Israel, Einstein wrote that the essential nature of Judaism resists the idea of a Jewish state with borders, an army, and a measure of temporal power. I am afraid of the inner damage Judaism will suffer, especially from the development of a narrow nationalism within our own ranks. In 1955, the year he died, Einstein wrote that our stance towards the Arab minority is a true touchstone of our moral standard. On March 13, 1955, in Einstein's last media statement published in the New York Post, he wrote that we had great hopes for Israel at first. We thought it might be better than other nations, but it is no better. Long gone are the days when the great astrophysicist and mathematician was a moral beacon for American Jewry, a quarter of whom voted for Trump. But Einstein remains a moral force for the great majority of us who see the neo-fascist Trump phenomena for what it is. The first edition of the venerable socialist magazine Monthly Review in 1953 featured an article by Albert Einstein titled, "Why I Am a Socialist." Einstein had fled Europe in the 1930s. He knew the ugly nature of a narrow nationalism. He understood that the world had outgrown nationalism and that a universalism, the solidarity of humankind, was what must come about. He recognized with his fellow Jew Rosa Luxemburg that the future was either socialism or barbarism. Creating and arming the new nation-state of Israel and overwhelming the Palestinians was a project Einstein understood to be an unfolding disaster. Kushner would have no idea what Einstein was writing about. Can whatever advice he gives his father-in-law help the situation? To pose the question is to answer it. Solidarity with Palestinians and not a war against Iran is needed now more than ever. Einstein, I'm sure, would have welcomed the boycott, divest, and sanction movement in opposition to a possible war against Iran. Now, BDS, that's a sign I can put on my refrigerator.
Communications Commission recently released a plan to do away with landmark regulations ensuring equal access to the Internet. These pave the way for Internet service companies to charge the public higher rates to see certain content and to even deny access to some websites. The proposal was made by the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, an opponent to regulation in general. Pai is the former Associate General Counsel for Verizon Communications Incorporated. The proposal is expected to be approved in mid-December. In his first year, Pai, who was appointed by Donald Trump, has already eliminated numerous regulations. The agency has stripped down rules governing TV broadcasters, newspapers, and telecom companies designed to protect the public interest. In addition to the net neutrality rollback, the chairman announced a plan to eliminate a rule limiting any corporation from controlling broadcasts that can reach more than 39% of American homes. In a broad brushstroke, the new proposal repeals rules put in place by the Obama administration that prohibit high-speed Internet service providers, or ISPs, from slowing down or even stopping the delivery of websites. The Obama rules prevent companies from charging customers extra fees for high-quality streaming and other services. These former rules were drafted to preserve the principle commonly known as net neutrality and to prevent practices that would create tiers of access to the Internet. The plan to repeal existing rules, passed in 2015, would reverse a hallmark decision by the agency to consider broadband as a public utility, and as essential to modern lives as telephones and electricities. This earlier decision created the legal foundation for the current rules and underscored the importance of high-speed Internet service. Joining us to discuss net neutrality and the proposed legislation is Attorney Gaurav Laroya, policy counsel at Free Press. Before joining Free Press, he worked at the Government Accountability Project, protecting the rights of national security whistleblowers. Gaurav, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tim Wu is credited with coining the term net neutrality. What does that mean?
Sure. So Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law, and he wrote a paper in 2003 about network neutrality. And that's the simple principle that the network itself, the conduits that carry information from point to point on the Internet, should treat all information equally and not discriminate against any of it by blocking or creating slow lanes or charging extra for access to different content online.
And as we're talking about terminology, what exactly is broadband?
Sure. So these network neutrality rules apply to broadband Internet access. And broadband itself is the kind of high-speed, always-on Internet access that most Americans use. And the FCC defines the speed at which broadband is. And right now, it's 25 megabits per second down and 1 megabit per second up. But as I said, the most important thing is this is how most Americans get online, even though there are significant gaps in low-income communities, rural areas, and tribal lands.
Okay, so who specifically is attacking the concept of net neutrality, and why?
It's actually a pretty small but a powerful group of people. Really only the three Republicans on the FCC, including Chairman Ajit Pai, and then all the Internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T. you know, the internet companies want these rules, entrepreneurs want these rules, and, you know, a vast majority of Americans on both sides of the aisle want to keep these rules. And why I think it's these companies don't think it's enough to be able to charge you monopoly prices on broadband access itself. They want to be able to charge you for access to your favorite sites and shake down companies on the other side of the internet, too. There's a huge amount of power and money on the line.
It's just stepping back, and this is from someone who doesn't know much about the internet, but the internet, I believe, was developed with public money, and I've always looked at it, at least it should be, like a public utility, like the water company or the phone company or the transit company. Am I correct to say that this looks like a power grab on the part of people that want to privatize what should be public?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a massive power grab, and you're right. A lot of money, public money, has gone into developing the internet. These rules are actually pretty simple. You know, they're allowed to charge reasonable fees for getting people online, and then and in exchange, they can't block content or speed up their own media content. And you know, they don't like it. They're trying to get the ability to do all that stuff back.
Now, Gaurav, I thought we'd already been through this and won some pretty strong net neutrality rules. Are we looking just at a revisiting of that?
Yeah, we did. We won really big in 2015. You know, the FCC's had net neutrality principles for years, but finally in 2015, they put them on the solid legal framework of Title II of the Communications Act, which lets the FCC regulate them as common carriers, so as an open network. And, you know, what happened, you know, elections have consequences, and I guess here we are. The FCC's chairman, Ajit Pai, has been against these rules from the start, and he's made it a personal mission to get rid of them, despite their benefits and popularity.
Okay, so before we got you on the air, Michael and I were sharing names of some of our favorite Netflix and online movies. We want to talk about how this matters in a larger sense, but in terms of our listening audience and what we do at night when we're relaxing, what practically might this look like if these rules are passed?
Sure. So I think one of the first things that's going to happen is what these companies tried to do and in some cases succeeded before 2015, which is shaking down companies like Hulu and Netflix for access to their customers, you and I, you know, when we're at home watching these services. And I think that could extend to, you know, the rest of the media environment too, whether it's music you listen to online or what you watch. I mean, that means higher prices for worse service, and then we're going to have to suffer through that.
So why does it matter in a larger sense for society, you know, businesses, small businesses, the economy, free speech, diversity, communications of people, activism, organizing, our own program, Law and Disorder? How might this all affect that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you care about social issues and your ability to access information online, that's what's at stake. I mean, this is about keeping the internet as, you know, kind of the glorious free-for-all that it is instead of a glorified cable network that these companies want it to be. So the ISPs stand between you and the broader internet, and now they want to use that power, which really implicates free speech in a major way, to block websites, speed up their own services, and slow down competitors. So, right, I have Verizon, and I don't think Verizon should have any say in what sites I'm allowed to access or in what ways I'm allowed to communicate online.
I've seen statistics on a number of progressive websites. These people are complaining that the number of hits they get are down substantially, anywhere from a third to a half, as a result of the changing of algorithms like Google can control when somebody asks a question, what kind of websites they're going to get to answer that question. Have you been reading about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've been reading about it. Now, that is a different issue than net neutrality, but, you know, obviously there are major issues with how these big internet gatekeepers allow access to the rest of the internet. And, you know, as this Google issues become more prevalent, we still don't think that power should be extended, you know, to Verizon and Comcast companies that we need to interact with to get online in the first place.
Now, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai wants to replace the FCC's, you know, current rules, as we've discussed, with so-called voluntary conditions. And the agency voted to move this proposal forward this past May. The FCC is going to vote on his plan in a couple of weeks, mid-December. What is the problem with these voluntary conditions, as they're mention.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, the order itself is actually straightforward. He wants to wipe away all the rules except for a couple transparency provisions, and they want us to believe that ISPs are going to keep their current promises not to block the Internet or throttle websites or create fast and slow lanes. I mean, really, the idea behind the order is that public shaming alone is going to change the behavior of these companies, and really that strains credulity. I mean, the order is remarkable in that it's really the first time the FCC wants an almost completely hands-off approach to ISPs. And this is the country's telecom regulator saying, you know, hey, not our problem to these companies. I mean, the proposed order actually gives a green light to these people to create fast lanes, even extract market rents. It's really everything AT&T and Comcast would have wanted. And if I can point out another particularly insidious item in the order, and it's that the FCC claims that it'll preempt states and cities from enacting their own net neutrality protections, so people may not even be able to save these rules at the local level.
Okay, let's just talk about that briefly, because when we talk about constitutional issues, the states are allowed to afford greater constitutional protections, I thought, than a federal law. This seems very strict.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really creating a regulatory race to the bottom. You know, we think that federal rules should be a floor, not a ceiling, but this is doing the exact opposite, preventing states from enacting strong consumer protections of these kinds in their own localities.
And you mentioned a few minutes ago cable TV, and you made me think, I remember when cable started, and there weren't commercials. Now, I had cable, but I got rid of it. Almost every single station had commercials every few minutes. And, of course, I remember, because I once worked in commercial operations in a TV station, there used to be rules that you could only have a certain number of minutes. I think it was 12 minutes per half hour of commercials. Of course, that's gone to the wayside under Ronald Reagan deregulation. Why, in a sort of societal protection way, do we need these rules? Is it an issue of a closed system that might look like our existing cable TV?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that's really part of the plan, is to create a kind of cable TV version of the Internet. I mean, the ISPs want to leverage their own power as the companies that stand between you and the brighter Internet, you know, to pad their bottom lines and really kind of force you into their own little walled media ecosystem. And I mean, that's what we get with cable. And like you said, people don't want that, the ability to access whatever information you want, whatever video you want, whatever music you want, without permission from Comcast or Verizon, I think is something people really care about.
What would it mean if the government was to reclassify broadband as a Title II telecommunications service under the 1934 Communications Act? Shouldn't they be common carriers, that where networks are open to all?
Yeah, I mean, so fortunately, after 10 years of legal wrangling, this is finally where we ended up in 2015. You know, the court said that if you want net neutrality rules, if you want to protect these networks as open networks and keep them open, they have to be classified as common carriers under Title II. And that's the provision, right, that keeps the phone networks open. It means that your phone company can't block certain numbers, or if you're not a customer of AT&T, you can't call someone that's on Verizon. That is the same kind of principle that is protecting the Internet right now as an open network, and they want to unreclassify out of that and get rid of all these rules.
What would be your worst nightmarish dystopian vision of what they might be able to accomplish with the Trump administration against us and against really essentially democratic rights of communication?
You know, fortunately, they've actually kind of articulated that in their own words. I mean, in 2012, Verizon, in its court filings, said they believe that they can access editorial control over the Internet in the same way that a newspaper can exercise editorial control of what's printed in its own pages. And I think that admission that they want to choose what people can see, you can imagine them bowing under political pressure by blocking the communications rights of activists or websites, or, you know, really stifling a lot of social movements right in the bud, because they have the power, they'll want to get the power to be able to do that. And I mean, that's terrifying, and it's something they've said they believe they're allowed to do.
Do you think that if these rules pass, and we'll discuss in a minute the next steps and what you think about might happen, is it possible that this could create a black market for videos so that, say, more users are driven to the dark net?
I would say that something like that is possible, but I think that actually underestimates the kind of power that these companies will be able to exert over the network. It means that, you know, those kind of services are available to people now because all legal content on the Internet is available to any user. If they can decide what pieces of information we're allowed to access and not, it means that, you know, these companies will be able to block sites like that, you know, if they choose to begin with.
So we might not even have access to the dark net.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Fascinating, and I'm sure the government would like nothing more than to shut that down.
Well, you can see kind of how this can steamroll into them exercising a lot of control over what we're allowed to do online.
Hmm. Now, what are the next steps? In mid-December, is it the FCC is going to vote on this?
Yes, that's true. So the chairman has released a draft order. We haven't seen the final order yet, but it'll look presumably very, very close to what's been released, and that is going to get voted on at the FCC on December 14th. And then, you know, we'll see what that looks like. And if it passes, I mean, there's still time.
We remember a couple of years ago the enormous outpouring of support on this issue, and it's happening again. I understand that over 20 million comments have come into the FCC on the issue of net neutrality. And you're at Free Press. Can you tell us a bit about Free Press and what you're doing on this issue?
Sure. I mean, so Free Press for more than 10 years has been fighting to keep Internet access open and help create a democratic media system in the United States that's actually responsive to people and elevates voices of people of color and marginalized communities. And part of that has been fighting for net neutrality. And like you said, the outpouring of support in favor of the current rules and against this proposal has been truly massive. I mean, we have allies on the Hill in Congress that have said, please stop calling. We get it. You know, tell the people that are against this that they need to call a GPI and tell them to please stop this proposal and keep the rules that are on the books. And, you know, like you said, there's still a lot of things people can do. There's still weeks before December 14th. You know, people can sign up to volunteer with Team Internet. So that's a grassroots network of net neutrality supporters, and that's run by Demand Progress, Fight for the Future, and the Free Press Action Fund, and that's at battleforthenet.com. Like I said, people should be calling their members of Congress on both sides of the aisle and telling them to save these protections and speak out against the chairman's plan. And, you know, we're also supporting protests outside Verizon stores on December 7th, and then there'll be a massive net neutrality rally in D.C. on December 14th, the day of the vote.
That's terrific. Battleforthenet.com.
That's correct.
But, Gaurav, let me ask you this. WWW, World Wide Web. The web is international, just not national. So are we talking about the United States doing something that impacts the world?
Oh, I mean, you know, what happens here matters a lot elsewhere. You know, other countries have closed networks, and this is, you know, there's a potential here to fracture the Internet into, you know, country-sized walled gardens, corporate-sized walled gardens. Our ability to access information abroad could be impacted. Like you said, this matters everywhere.
It's really ominous, just thinking about it. We've been so fortunate thus far to not have this crackdown.
What I'm worried about is that the FCC is made up, if I understand it correctly, 5 people, 2 Democrats and 3 Republicans. So isn't it our task to try to sway one of these 3 Republicans?
I think that's right. And I think the best leverage point is talking to our representatives in Congress and telling the commissioners on the FCC to stop, that people really care about these rules. I think that is where they are going to be convinced.
We wanted to ask you, if you don't mind, how you personally became interested in this issue, how you came to Free Press. You were at Government Accountability Project before.
Yeah, that's correct. So I was working on whistleblower protections and privacy at the Government Accountability Project. And you know, I have a colleague at Free Press that says, you know, if you care about any issue, you also care about net neutrality. And, you know, I actually came to Free Press as a privacy lawyer. You know, at the end of the last administration, the FCC was working on and passed rules preventing ISPs from snooping on our web browsing history and selling that to advertisers and, you know, further violating people's privacy rights. Republicans in Congress wiped away those rules earlier this year, and now we're here trying to protect the rules that are still on the books. So, you know, I've learned this last year that nothing is ever over, and we've got to keep fighting if we want to protect what we've got.
Speaking of fighting, say this passes. Do you expect lawsuits to be filed?
Yeah, like I said, we haven't seen the final order yet, but if they move forward, we will definitely sue. What the FCC is doing here is really a total abdication of responsibility by an agency over the entities they're supposed to be watchdogging, and based on incredibly weak reasoning. I think they're really vulnerable here.
Well, yeah, the only problem, and in fact, we're going to do a segment of our show on it, is that the Republicans are stacking the courts with judges that probably wouldn't be inclined to rule in favor of our lawsuit. So we've got a whole network of bad stuff coming down.
That is true, but it is worth noting that these rules have been upheld twice in the D.C. Circuit and relatively recently. The courts have said multiple times that if you want net neutrality, it has to be under Title II under the current framework. Trying to do something else, I think the courts are going to say that we've told you multiple times it's not going to work.
Good, refreshing news. Thank you.
Gaurav, we have just a few minutes remaining, and one of the issues you touched on, but I wondered if you could expand upon, is the dangers, say, to communities of color, activists, the people that we regularly interview on Law and Disorder.
This is a really big deal for activists and communities of color. Think about all the things this Congress and administration would have done in the dead of night if we had to wait until the next morning to read about it in the paper. I think our ability to organize in this environment is predicated on access to quick and open information, and that's what's at stake. A neutral internet lets everyone engage in public discourse, lets stories from marginalized communities reach the wider world, and it's not hard to imagine one of these companies bowing to political pressure and blocking activists' websites or their communications. And it matters for entrepreneurs and small businesses, too. If you've got a product to sell or a startup to launch right now, you can reach anyone online. I mean, imagine if Comcast strikes a deal to slow down a non-affiliated shopping site or applications they can't get a fee from. It would crush these small businesses. And that's reflected in the record. Activists, small businesses, and startups have all come out strongly in favor of keeping these rules.
We've been speaking with Attorney Gaurav Leroy, who's the policy counsel at the Free Press. Gaurav, before we have to say goodbye, give us those sites again where people can get more information on how to do something about this.
Oh, sure. Well, first, definitely look up Free Press and also check out battleforthenet.com, and that's where you can sign up for Team Internet. It's a network of people that are going to be out there trying to protect these rules.
Well, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We want to stay in touch with you as these developments work their way through our system. It's been really a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Likewise.
Thank you, Gaurav. You take it easy, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The United States of America imprisons more of its citizens, both in absolute numbers and as a percentage of the population, than any other country in the world. Only China comes close. On any given day, 2,300,000 Americans are in jail or prison. 70% of them are non-white. Former Alabama Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions wants these numbers to rise. He's instructed federal prosecutors to prosecute people for the most serious possible crime and to demand the longest possible sentence. In the last 30 years, the number of people in jail and in prison has skyrocketed by a factor of 5. Prosecutors are increasingly demanding life sentences without the possibility of parole. Judges have lost their discretion with the implementation of maximum minimum sentencing. The long-term impact of mass incarceration has been devastating, especially to black communities. Attorney General Sessions has stated that there is a dangerous permanent rise in violent crime, despite FBI data showing a sharp decline in the last 20 years. He has falsely charged that crime increases have been caused by immigrants and that prosecutorial policy under Obama caused crime to increase. Here to speak with us today is Mark Maurer, the executive director of the Sentencing Project and a central figure in the justice reform movement. The Sentencing Project is a Washington, D.C.-based research and advocacy group working to reduce the use of incarceration in the United States and to address racial disparities in the criminal justice system.
Mark Maurer, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Why do you think mass incarceration is ineffective?
Well, what we know is that, yes, prison has some effect on crime. There are some people who present a real danger to the public, and that's why they need to be isolated for some period of time. But what we've done with mass incarceration is we've gone so far beyond the point of diminishing returns that the whole system is very counterproductive now. You know, we've done that in a couple of ways. One is that we keep people in prison far longer than they need to be in many cases. The person convicted of robbery at the age of 25, by the time he's 35 or 40 years old, he's generally going to be much less of a risk for public safety than that 25-year-old was. And yet, we often keep people there for decades and decades, wasting money. We also put people in prison who don't present a real threat to public safety, could be handled in a community setting, but instead we spend enormous sums of money keeping them behind bars when other more effective options would be available.
And what do you think are the long-term social impacts of mass incarceration?
Well, particularly in low-income communities of color, particularly in African-American communities, the figures are really shocking and, you know, portend for very bad outcomes. The most recent research on this was done by the Department of Justice back in 2001. At the time, they looked at current rates of incarceration by race and gender and concluded that if current rates continue, then one of every three black boys born that year could expect to go to prison at some point in his lifetime. One of every six Latino boys, one of every 17 white boys. The figures for women were lower overall, but we see racial ethnic disparities there as well. So when it comes to a point when, for black males growing up, they see that in many neighborhoods it's far more likely to go to prison than it is to college, that's a really devastating statement about our social policies and what happens. And this has all kinds of repercussions in terms of family formation and stability, in terms of neighborhood cohesion, when people are cycling in and out of prisons all the time. This is very bad for stability and informal means of crime control and diverts enormous resources. We spend about $80 billion a year through our system of mass incarceration now, and clearly we could have many more productive uses for those funds if we chose a different set of policies.
Mark, what were the get-tough-on-crime policies that characterized sentencing policy in the 1980s and the 1990s, and what are the current policies as propounded by Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions?
Yeah. Well, the tough-on-crime era, much of that was premised on two changes. One, sending more people to prison, and two, keeping them there for longer periods of time. Much of this involved changes in drug policy, but not only drug policy. So the war on drugs really ramped up beginning in the mid-1980s. We went from a point where there were about 40,000 people in prison or jail for a drug offense in 1980. Today, that figure is more than 400,000 people. Much of this also involved adopting mandatory minimum sentences that took discretion away from judges to consider individual cases and circumstances. Again, many of these policies were applied to drug offenses, but others as well, and essentially required a judge to impose a term of 5, 10, 20 years, or even life, depending on the offense, with no ability to adjust for local circumstances. So that has contributed substantially to mass incarceration. Since Attorney General Sessions has been in office, he's in very significant ways reversed the policies of his predecessors, initially Eric Holder and then Loretta Lynch, in several areas. One, they had announced in the Obama administration they were phasing out the use of private prison contracting at the federal level. Then they had also announced that they were charging federal prosecutors to use their discretion and to avoid charging mandatory minimum sentences in lower-level drug cases and the like. And Sessions, you know, within a couple of months, had reversed both of those orders. So the private prison operators are doing just fine now. He's called for prosecutors to seek the highest provable offense they can in every case. And I should note that, you know, the duty of prosecutors, according to Bar Association standards and the like, is not to seek the harshest penalty in every case, but to do justice in every case. And justice doesn't always look like the harshest penalty that you can find. So it's very clear, taking us back to the bad old days of the 1980s, 1990s, even as many of his colleagues and political partisans have moved on, moved away from those tough-on-crime policies.
Mark, you referred to life sentences, and I understand that currently over 200,000 individuals are serving life without parole or what we call virtual life, long sentences such as 50 years or more. Do you note a trend in states and the federal government in terms of sentencing individuals to life? Is it increasing?
Yes, very much so, and it's very disturbing. Yes, you're correct. There are more than 200,000 people serving life. And to put some perspective on that, it's about one of every seven people in state and federal prisons. And, you know, clearly, as we're now at a moment when there's some momentum to challenge mass incarceration, if we can't take on the massive imposition of life sentences, we're going to be very limited as to what kinds of prison population reductions we can achieve. These figures have been going up even as crime rates have been declining for about 20 years now. Some of this are increases in life without parole, but even when it's life with the possibility of parole, in many states, parole boards and governors are making parole less likely or more restrictive. Frequently, they will increase the number of years you have to wait before you can even go to the parole board. If you get turned down, they may increase the waiting time until your next hearing. Lifers are also disadvantaged because there's generally very limited programming in most prison systems. The resources are not there, and lifers are often left out of much of that programming, with the idea being, well, they're not getting out anyway, so we should focus our resources on those who may get out. Well, that's understandable in one sense, but it also means that lifers then have less to show to a parole board in terms of accomplishments in prison, transitions in their lives, things like that. So the numbers keep piling up with serious implications for the scale of the population in prisons.
Mark, the Sentencing Project puts out an excellent newsletter, and I'm a supporter and I get it regularly. And I just read that statistically, you write that there are 17,000 people in prison for life who've done nonviolent offenses. What's wrong with that?
you know, what's wrong with that is that there need to be consequences for people who break the law, but those consequences should be proportional to the harm done and should serve some public safety purpose. You know, we saw examples of how this plays out in the commutations of sentence that President Obama issued largely in his last 2 years in office. He issued sentence commutations to more than 1,700 people. Of that total, nearly a third were serving life without parole for drug crimes. Now, I don't want to suggest that these were, you know, kids on the street corner smoking pot. In most cases, it was several drug crimes. They were selling drugs, often significant quantities of drugs. Nonetheless, to put away people for life without parole, far harsher sentence than is often given out, even in crimes most people would consider more serious, is really just a fundamental waste of resources and, you know, real, I think, violation of human rights standards and any kind of compassion. So, you know, it always sounds good when political leaders, you know, get up and say, three strikes and you're out, we're going to take care of this problem. And we've heard this from both Democrats and Republicans in the past. But as a strategy for public safety and using resources, it's been a complete failure. And it means that we have increasing numbers of elderly people in prison serving no public safety purpose, but just, again, draining resources from other interventions we could use.
So we talked about nonviolent crimes. Let me ask you a hard question, Mark, if I might. What about long sentences for violent crimes? Don't we have to come to grips with that, too?
We certainly do, and yes, there are some people, you know, have committed serious crimes, and that's why we have prisons for some people who are really dangerous to the public. You know, we also know I started my career many years ago, did a lot of work in the state of Michigan, spent a lot of time with a lifers group at Jackson Prison, which at the time was the largest walled prison in the country. And the men that I got to know through that group, typically their background had been they were 17, 18, 19, running around with the wrong group of people. One night someone went in to rob a pharmacy or something, and things got out of hand, and all of a sudden it was an armed robbery or perhaps somebody was killed. Now we see them in prison 20, 25 years later, and as is true for all of us, people become adult-like. They mature, they grow out of those young, wilder years, and many of them become very responsible people. If you talk to prison wardens, they will uniformly tell us that lifers are the stable element of their prison systems. They rely on lifers for leadership and for maturity, essentially. So in many cases, not necessarily all, but in many cases, these people are very different than their youthful selves and would represent only a very minimal risk to public safety if they're released. And their chances of success will depend on what we, through the correction system and the community, can provide in terms of support and services to integrate them back into the community. So, yes, you know, prison is a very harsh punishment, but it doesn't mean that we need to impose it for life in order to send a message or have appropriate consequences for their crimes. We should do it only to the extent that it's necessary for public safety and for, you know, the goals of the system as we set it up.
Mark, I used to work for an alternatives to incarceration program for teenagers and young adults, and we always stressed that the human mind is not completely formed. And of course, as you've alluded to, juveniles make errors. I noticed that the Sentencing Project has a recent report called Juvenile Life Without Parole, and it says that approximately 2,100 individuals sentences juveniles to life without the possibility of parole now have a chance for release in the wake of recent Supreme Court decisions. Can you talk briefly about that?
Sure. It's been a very intriguing the last decade or so. There have actually been three separate cases that have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court on juvenile life without parole, and the combined results of these cases have been to scale back the use of this penalty, which is extreme by world standards. The first case essentially said you can't be sentenced as a juvenile to life without parole if it's a non-homicide case. The second one, most substantial, said it can't be imposed as a mandatory penalty. What we had previously in a state like Pennsylvania, for example, which has one of the highest populations of youth serving life without parole, if you were charged with certain serious violent offenses and you were 16 or 17, you would automatically be waived into adult court, and if you were convicted, you were automatically sentenced to life without parole. There was no intervention or consideration by the judge. And the court essentially, in its several rulings, said that basically children are different, again, looking at levels of maturity and acknowledging that recent brain research and other findings show that it's not until the age of 24, 25 that young people truly mature, can appreciate the consequences of their actions, can be less impulsive in their actions and the like. And the court essentially said it's now going to affect something like 2,100 people that they need to be resentenced and have consideration of their youth taken into account. It's possible in some cases an individual judge would still sentence them to life without parole, but it can't be done across the board as one size fits all anymore, and we're expecting to see a substantial reduction in those numbers in the coming years now.
Mark, calls to end mass incarceration seem to be abounding throughout the nation now. But increasingly, use of life imprisonment suggests substantial reduction in incarceration may be limited unless policymakers address punishment for crimes that include violence along with offenses involved in drugs. Are you optimistic in this regard?
Well, it's going to take a lot of work. I think there's growing understanding that we have to look at more serious offenses as well. For many political leaders, you know, who are slow to get on the bandwagon of challenging mass incarceration, they've now become comfortable with changing policies and practices for low-level drug offenses, looking to use treatment rather than incarceration in many of those cases. So we're seeing some shifts there. It's considerably more difficult when it comes to violent offenses, though, even though we and many others have pointed out the challenges that are before them in dealing with this. At the Sentencing Project, we've been proposing that we should really establish an upper limit of 20 years maximum for a prison term, except in unusual cases, and that's premised on the idea that people do age out of the high crime rate years. We have diminishing returns for public safety by keeping people locked up for decades or life. And there's nothing unusual about such a policy in many comparable nations. In many parts of Western Europe, it's, you know, extremely rare for anybody to get more than 20 years in prison, and based on all these understandings is why they do that. Here in the United States, you can go to any courtroom in any big city on a given day and see people routinely getting 20 years or more for drug offenses and others that are not by far the most serious offenses on the books. So, yes, it's going to be challenging to extend that conversation. I think there is growing understanding that we need to do this, and I think there are some thoughtful corrections leaders who are even looking at some of these changes or possibilities right now, too.
And in addition to that, are there other more humane and effective public safety approaches that you might recommend we take in general toward crime?
Well, I think, you know, the big picture in many ways is that, you know, many people have known for a long time, we really have a two-tiered system of justice. You know, we have one for people with resources and means that often allows them to resolve their problems outside of the justice system completely. You know, when middle-class parents find out that their kid has been using drugs or the kid has been doing shoplifting and the like, you know, they often have the ability to deal with the problem through treatment programs and other kinds of interventions, and this criminal justice system is usually pretty sympathetic to that. When it's low-income kids having the same problem, we treat that as a criminal justice problem instead. You know, that's where, you know, the whole idea of the school-to-prison pipeline comes in. Problems that were once handled within the school and the community now are much more likely to be going straight to the juvenile justice court as a first step. So I think we need to expand our ideas about public safety and how it's produced, shift more towards expanding opportunity rather than relying on punishment. You know, prisons, the justice system should be the last resort, not the first option that we look at, and we shouldn't just do that for people with means, but that's a better approach in every community.
We just have a few minutes remaining. Could you speak briefly on the issue of private prisons? I understand that the federal prison system leads the nation with the largest number of persons incarcerated in private facilities. What's wrong with these?
Well, the problem is, you know, where we're talking about taking away someone's liberty and doing it as a means of enriching private contractors, essentially. And I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that. You know, on a practical basis, there are many problems. One is oversight. You know, when you contract with a private prison, the state or the federal government should be examining what happens there, but there's often much less oversight. Often the contractors are in completely different states. So, for example, in Hawaii, there's severe overcrowding in the prisons. They've contracted with private prisons in Arizona and have hundreds of people there, which means that those people don't get family visits. If they have a legal case pending, they can't consult with their lawyers, and certainly much less oversight as well. So it's the profit motive that's driving things, and it gets exacerbated by all the practical realities of private prisons and how they play out.
Yeah, well, thankfully, we don't have any private prisons in New York State, but I'm afraid that Sessions is going to be campaigning for more private prisons around the country. Mark, we're coming to an end of our allotted time, and Heidi and I wanted to ask you on a personal note, if you might, how did you get involved in this kind of work?
Well, I have a graduate degree in social work from the University of Michigan and had to do a field placement, and there was a local Quaker office in town of the American Friends Service Committee. I heard they took on graduate students, so I went by there, and there was a elderly Quaker woman who was very concerned about the problem of bail and pretrial detention, was starting a community bail fund. So I ended up doing internships there, worked on a bail fund, started going to prisons and looking around and asking questions. And that's why I'm delighted these days to see that the issue of bail is finally coming to the forefront, and we're seeing more community bail funds and critiques of money bail. It should have happened a long time ago, but it's encouraging that there's finally some attention to that real entry point for the whole system of mass incarceration.
Mark, how can listeners learn more about your work and the Sentencing Project?
Yeah. Well, our website has a wealth of information and contacts and the like, and that's sentencingproject.org. Our staff are available to do public speaking at events and conferences. We work at the state and local level, and we can consult on advocacy campaigns. So we encourage everybody to write to us, and you can just do that directly through the website.
And Mark, we want to thank you for your decades of work in this field. You're truly a leader in sentencing reform. And we
appreciate thank
that.
You so much. And it's great to see that, you know, our numbers are really expanding at a dramatic pace these days. So I think we have reasons to be optimistic over the next decade or so.
Well, you can count on Heidi and I. We're in your corner. Mark Meyer, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Michael, recently several community radio stations have been running Law and Disorder. We haven't thanked them yet.
No, we've been acquired and we're thrilled. We want to thank KWRKLP 90.9 at the Alaska Peace Center in Fairbanks, Alaska.
And WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio.
And WOOC WOOC at 105.3 FM in Troy, New York.
WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We also have Workforce Rising Online carrying us, and WMNBLP 107.1 FM in North Adams, Massachusetts.
And last in Seattle, Washington, we have KODXLP at 96.9 FM.
Welcome, stations. We're thrilled to have you in our family.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you. Please let us know how you like the show and any questions you have.
Oh, praise.